you know, we are all facing with how our bodies are dealing with the spike protein, if we got the shot or got the disease, and we need to figure out how to respond to spike protein disease, which the great doctors who put on the FLCCC conference in Dallas this last week, you know, they are really, really researching that at a very deep level. And they've got all kinds of therapies and treatments that they're trying out. And I really believe, just like they figured out how to treat COVID back in 2020, they're going to figure out how to fight spike protein disease, as well as the problems with the lipid nanoparticles that go throughout the body and the other contaminants that we see in the vials. So, you know, I think that is coming. And I'm bringing that up for a reason. As a lawyer, I need experts. And I need researchers and experts to make the case. So these doctors and researchers are really about developing the basis in order to assign blame and liability where it's due. The other thing that I'm working on, of course, is the fraud. So I represent Brooke Jackson, and she's alleging fraud in the very first instance here in the clinical trials. And if people don't know about Brooke Jackson's case, it's essentially that, you know, these clinical trials were so mishandled, so poorly run, that there's really no valid data that could come out of those trials that would be possible to underlie an FDA decision. And the only reason they got to that data that they ultimately submitted is because they lied. They lied to the FDA, they lied to the American people, they lied to the Department of Defense, which is the ultimate contractor for this shot. So if we can knock out and prove fraud, which is going to be a long battle, that helps to take out one of the keystones of this entire edifice that they built around this health and safety Trojan horse that they've foisted upon us.
Right. Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update, folks. You just heard from a man of action, and you're going to hear a lot more from Attorney Warner Mendenhall in just a minute, because he's here with us tonight to give us updates on the many, many cases that he's handling for patients who are suffering from vaccine injuries or lost their jobs, their careers even, to, you know, just because they refuse to follow vaccine mandates, or who know, as Brooke Jackson knows, that the, you know, she worked for Pfizer, and, you know, she was in on the clinical trial, and she knew that it wasn't being done properly. It wasn't even close to scientific standards, and that's a nice way of saying it. Warner Mendenhall is looking for medical experts, as he says, to help him win these cases, to tell judges what should have been done by Pfizer, by hospitals, by doctors and employers, according to the law. And as he said, you know, he's found medical experts right here at the FLCCC. I'm Betsy Ashton, not a medical expert. I'm just a creative director, an old reporter with this alliance. But our two top medical experts, Drs. Paul Marek and Pierre Corey, are with us tonight, and they're going to be in conversation with Warner Mendenhall. You can start typing your questions in for them, for all of them, right into Q&A now. We have nurses already on the screen. They're already behind the scenes, and they'll answer as many of the questions as they can. They always do a tremendous job. I'll bring several of them back here to the doctors and a lawyer so that you'll be all be able to hear the questions that seem to be the most pertinent to all of you. So without further ado, let's get Paul and Pierre in here, and let me welcome Warner Mendenhall. Please tell our friends out there, you know, what inspired you to get in this fight, into this line of work? You know, you weren't even a lawyer when you saw something wrong. Am I right?
I started a long time ago. I mean, the first thing that I saw was a breakdown in governmental accountability. and also in corporate accountability. And I essentially acted as my own whistleblower within the city of Akron. We saw a lot of corruption and issues there. We saw them not following the law. You know, all the things I think we're all familiar with now. And the same patterns occur at local governments all around the country, at the state level, and then the federal level. You know, we really have this regulatory capture that has just continued to expand through my lifetime and through my career as an attorney. So that's what got me started. And then, you know, the COVID crisis itself just appeared to me to be a tremendous acceleration of the problems that we had been dealing with anyway, with corporate corruption, with government failure and the failure of accountability in government. And in that sense, I don't know that anyone was really ready to go, but we were maybe readier than most because we had been doing this since the 90s. And I have a nice little crew of attorneys here. We know how to fight local, state, and federal government. And we started taking them on along with the corporations that really also impose their will right along with government on the employees. So that's what started it all.
Yeah, let me just jump in. I just want to say a couple of words about Warner is that he's literally one of my favorite people that I've worked with and met and traveled with. Warner, we've been at a number of events and conferences and lectures. And yeah, you literally have 30 years of fighting fraud, corporate and governmental fraud. And so just like I think Paul and I and my time for our careers to shine, you know, the pinnacle of our careers during this. And I think we have. I think I want to say the same about you and your firm and what you're doing. And we're excited to hear about your cases and what's going on the legal front, because I'm going to finish by saying this. I've been saying this for 2 years, man. It's time for the lawyers. Like, I'm sick and tired of being the doctor pointing out the corruption of the data and the science and the policies. Like, there needs to be accountability and we need some course correction. And only the lawyers can do that. So we admire you and appreciate the work you're doing.
Well, a lawyer can't do anything without the wonderful clients that we have. And Betsy mentioned Brooke Jackson and her case against Pfizer. And, you know, Brooke stood up immediately in 2020. Her case has been going on since the fall of 2020 when she alerted the FDA to the fraud and the problems in the clinical trials and was fired 6 hours later. And it's been quite a saga in her case. But so many people have stood up. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I maybe have a very different perspective than the average person on this, because what I see are millions of people who stood up and gave up their jobs and stood for their beliefs and stood for their families and stood for correcting the misdirection of our government. And those millions of people, you know, we happen to have the honor of representing some of them and in all kinds of different fields, from small business owners to employees to medical personnel across this nation. And I'm just so proud of the clients and the people who did stand up. And certainly it's an honor to be on here. You guys were so critical. And I'll tell you how I got onto you guys. It was in the spring of 2020, Paul. Your work at treatment, I thought you guys had solved the problem. I thought, oh, the crisis is over about what, April, May of 2020. I thought these guys got it. They figured it out. We can all go home, open everything back up. But boy, it didn't turn out that way, did it?
Warner, I'm so glad to hear that you were as naive as I was. So we started in the same place.
Isn't it the way it ended? Didn't we solve the problem and it ended?
Yeah, well, that's what should have happened. Had things been working properly, that's what should have happened. This thing should have been over. You know, and Ohio is a very interesting place to live because we have a huge Amish population, which rejected the vaccination. Mm. You know, the problem was over for them in the summer of 2020, and it hasn't really come back. And their death rates are very, very low. There was no real spike. They had a little bit of a pull forward effect as their elderly did get sick and suffered, just like they would with the flu or anything else. But the community survived and thrived and just moved right on through this. No masking, no distancing, nothing. They continued to worship and work the way they always have. In fact, I think their business has probably improved because they were supplying a lot of goods and services to the community.
You know, Warner, you bring up the Amish because they're just so interesting to look at, like their health status as a society, you know, in comparatively to the U.S. Because, you know, when you do that with, I don't want to get off topic here, but with childhood vaccines, and you see like they have like literally, I think, a near nil or zero rate of autism right. or ADHD, you know, and they've long shunned vaccines. And so, I mean, they're really important and data source, you know, to look at sort of comparative health strategies. And I like that you just kind of summarized how well they did by just keeping cool, staying out of the fray. And yeah, it affected them, but not markedly. And they're doing well.
They don't watch television. Everybody, yep. I mean, I know we're all here on the internet and we're talking about this issue, but turn it off, folks. You know, just turn it off. You know, these sources, especially the mainstream sources, are not to be trusted anymore. They're as corrupt and bought off as anybody. You know, we all know that pharma provides, I think it's 70% of their advertising revenue at this point. So there is no independent media out there that can be trusted no corporate media that I think at this point can be trusted. There is independent media. A lot of that. Grown and you guys are an example of that. Yep. So turn off the TV though.
Yeah, we're an independent health organization, right? We really do strive to have no conflicts of interest and just talk about data and medicine and just keep the rest out of it. And I think it allows us to do good work.
Yep.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us about this evil mammoth thing called Pfizer? Are we going to be able to take them down? And, you know, how's the case with Brooke going?
Because are we?
Well, you know, I think they're near the center of all evil.
Well, Pfizer, as you know, they have lost a tremendous amount of stock value as the ineffectiveness and the lack of safety has come more to light. You know, clearly people are not taking boosters at any kind of the rate that they predicted. And Pfizer itself is a company that has always been in trouble. They have paid billions of dollars in fines and criminal penalties through the years. They're involved in lawsuits right now in obviously the clinical trial, in adulteration of the medicines, in Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And one of the things that we would say as lawyers, because we've been fighting pharmaceutical companies and the medical industry for years. It's not a recent thing for me. And we really have a saying that fraud is the business model. Do the fraud, collect the money, and pay some small percentage of that to get out of trouble. So Pfizer's made hundreds of billions of dollars. So what if they pay a few billion back? They just consider that a tax to support their business model at this point, as do many of these pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, so, Warner, on that issue, because I've made that argument in a narrow space, but that part of that business model is destroying and distorting the evidence of efficacy of off-patent medicines. Like that is their single greatest Achilles heel, is cheap, safe, older drugs that do not afford them massive profits. And I think I wrote a book about that in terms of using ivermectin as a case study. But yeah, oh, nice. but no, you're absolutely right. Fraud is their business model. It's a shocking industry. I think, you know, all industries have the capacity for fraud and putting profits against people's interests. But pharma does a particularly devastating job of doing that.
Well, I mean, what I see, obviously, and you know this way better than me, but they've captured your profession. They've captured it starting at medical school and moving on through. And then beyond that, I mean, all these protocols that have been built up, you know, we've lost the independent doctor who really acted as a scientist in their practice. The art of medicine is gone. And now we have technicians who follow protocols that at this point seem to be mandated from on high. You know, there was a day in this country in my lifetime when the doctor was a scientist who would test things and think about things and consider their patient and try different things to make it work. And I know you guys are still that way. But we have lost that in the medical profession, unfortunately. And we see it all the time. We just see it all the time. And
yeah.
One of the worst things that I see happening right now, one of the things that I don't think we've all felt the impact of, but I've seen it up close and personal, are the most experienced doctors and most experienced nurses who are walking away from the profession. They are sick to death and fed up with the way it's being handled right now, with the administration and even non-doctors telling them how to treat their patients. So that's, we have seen that. I know it's been, it's having a devastating impact right now. I think that will be pretty clear within a couple of years as well.
You know, Warner, on that issue, I had an interesting conversation today with someone I hadn't talked to in a while. It's a former, very close colleague of mine that I did a lot of teaching and research with. He's still in the system. And we hadn't talked in a while. He just recounted what it's been like the last few years, because he did try to speak up and push back against a bunch of stuff. But it was very clear that the door was going to be open for him to exit immediately if he continued. So he held back. He has young children. But a couple of things that he said, and I think it speaks to what your point is he said, this is a major academic medical center, but that the nurse practitioners are now being elevated more and more into positions of leadership. Now, I love nurse practitioners. I work with them. My partner is one. I've taught them for years. I've found them in many times more open-minded and more teachable than my colleagues, like my peer attendings. But I do think with this rigid control and having NPs and what we call mid-level providers now in more and more positions and doing more and more of the medical care, they're much more influenced and controllable by protocols, by rigid, like they'll follow orders and protocols much more easily than a physician will, especially an experienced physician who knows when something's BS and knows when something doesn't make sense for their patient. And I'm so terrified of what's happening to that system. And you're speaking to an audience tonight. I would say the majority of our audience are terrified about going to hospitals or going to a system doctor because they've seen what's happened over the last 3 years.
And they should be.
Yeah, exactly. Tell us about where is Brooks and your case with Pfizer? Like, what point are we at, and what do you think is going to happen going forward? And then tell us about, I want to hear about your firm, because I know you have tons of cases on a number of areas of COVID fraud and sort of
employment issues, doctors, yes, hospital issues, false claims issues with hospitals and other people. It's an endless process. We'll get into that in just a minute. But the Brooke Jackson case, I just want people to understand, it's a simple case. This is not complicated in terms of having to think about it. It's very, very simple. Obviously, they have all the money in the world. Obviously, when we show up at court, they've got 20 lawyers over there, to our little group. But it doesn't matter. It's a very simple case. They had a requirement to have a trial, a clinical trial that was adequate and well-controlled. Just remember those two terms, adequate and well-controlled. So what Brooks showed immediately was that the trial was out of control. Like, there wasn't the properly trained people doing the injections, handling the patients. There was unblinding. There was a failure to report adverse events. All kinds of stuff were going on. So it was not well controlled. And if it's not well controlled, it's inadequate. The data that comes out of a chaotic situation is not data that should be or could be even relied on to make decisions. We need well controlled data, well controlled situation in order to generate adequate data. So that is that's as simple as it gets. And then let's look at what happens when you unblind the participants. And there's going to be two phases that I'll talk about. The first one is the one with roughly 44,000 people in it, 22,000 in the control arm, 22,000 in the quote unquote vaccine arm. And what we saw in that, and this is where the unblinding comes in, is you can see in the way the data was managed. So if we take a 30,000 foot view of it, roughly the same amount of people in both arms got COVID. If you just look at the overall data, it's roughly the same. There's a few hundred difference, but it's statistically insignificant. So roughly the same amount get COVID in each arm. Only after you start doing these exclusions and boil 44,000 people down to 170 endpoints, right? Where they're excluding far more people from the vaccine arm, including all those that got COVID, do you get this 90% efficacy rate that they came up with? You know, with 162 of those 170 were in the control arm that got COVID and 8 in the vaccine arm. So again, this is simple elementary school math. I think everybody can understand it. And we ought to all understand that the overall data, if you just look at it without all the exclusions, it's roughly the same.
Yep.
And but and then you boil it down and they come up with this 90% efficacy. And I don't know why nobody was questioning that in the beginning. So that's
Warner, what you're really referring to is something we've talked about in medicine, which is this amplification of the relative efficacy rather than the absolute, you know, relative risk reduction versus absolute. Like you just said, the absolute risk reduction, I think in that best manipulated case scenario was, I think, either 1% or less than 1% reduction in your chance of getting COVID. Relatively, you know, because they did all the shenanigans, it looked awesome, but an average citizen, I mean, it really had almost no impact in protecting you.
And then the other thing that we look at, this goes again to the unblinding. One of the things that shows the unblinding is the reporting of adverse events in the trial. So the reporting of adverse events, if you were in the vaccine arm, was delayed. So whereas in the control arm, it was under 5 days that the adverse event would be reported. In the vaccine arm, I think it was up to like 17 days on average in the delay. Now that affected the data cutoff date. So people were being, the adverse events were being reported after the November 14th, 2020 data cutoff date, but they weren't provided to the FDA to show efficacy. So it's clear, this is what unblinding does. You can see that both arms were treated differently, very differently. And it's only because they were unblinded. The researchers knew whether you had the shot or didn't have the shot, and it was biased. All the reporting was biased in order to get to that efficacy and safety number that they presented finally to the FDA. And remember, 170, I'll keep coming back to that. We have injected billions of injections based on 170 people.
And Warner, on this issue, because you speak very well about this, is this something that happens in a courtroom? Like, because this is somewhat of a scientific discussion. Like, is this something that you've argued like in court before a jury or a judge?
Well,
about the failure.
I pray to God that one day we get before a jury on this. Like I say, I think it is so simple. Any juror with an elementary education could understand this math and could understand that that doesn't look right. And then let's go one step further. I mean, one of the things that they were trying to show initially was they had the same amount of deaths in each arm, right? So the overall mortality rate. Well, it turns out they hid some deaths and they hid some injuries and didn't turn those in. So what ends up happening is that the riskiest place to be in that experiment was in the vaccine arm. You were taking your life in your hands. You were going to come out of there with those 9 pages of adverse reactions that are single space that Pfizer presented. You could come out dead or injured, like some of the folks have reported. And I mean, it just goes on and on. But I want to emphasize how simple it is. The second issue that is out here is that was all what we call process one.
Now you're talking.
Process one was, you know, a very purified product that was used in the trials. They came up with another process, and that's called process two when they scaled this up to create billions of doses. And process two was only tested. There weren't 44,000 people in that trial. There were 252. So, I mean, it's absurd, folks. It's completely.
And that's a total of both arms. It was 250 and it was split into two groups. It was a
252, period, were who they tested process two on, period. And so we don't even have, I mean, it's just impossible to have any kind of perspective on what process two did. And process two, of course, you've talked to Kevin McKernan and he's explained the issue with process two. I'm sure your audience is familiar with that. Yeah. But in order to scale up, the process one involved a magnetic nanoparticle that would separate out the mRNA. And I know everybody's probably laughing right now because, you know, I remember, you know, when some of people were talking about magnets and whatnot, and that got blown up by the media as idiocy. But they actually used magnetic nanoparticles to separate out the mRNA and process one and to purify the product. So that there is an element of truth in the issue of magnets. But process two is based on a E. coli bacterial platform that then grows and grows and grows in big vats and result, and they pull out mRNA from that vat. The problem is some of that DNA from the E. coli slips through. It's not purified completely. So it slips through and it is really, really unknown what that is going to do and is doing. I mean, I think a lot of the problems we're seeing have to do with that. We need a lot more research on that as well. And then moving on, one more thing, I guess, that you're aware of as well is the simian virus 40 segment. There is a simian virus 40 segment, and that segment is used in research to drive changes to DNA. So that segment, and that segment itself, when it was put in the polio vaccine accidentally, I guess, back in the day, it did cause cancers and things like that. So there's a real fear about that. But there's a segment of SV40 that is used in research, and it is to change DNA and to get that mRNA into your DNA. And we don't know all the outcomes of that. And thanks to Kevin McKernan for helping us understand that. And then there's another one. It's something that Kevin calls an open frame. It's a long chain of amino acids. I think he said it's over 1,200 amino acid chain. And the problem with that is it causes protein misfolding. And protein misfolding can lead to things like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and other very serious diseases. And all of this is worrisome. And all of it has only really been tested on 252 people.
So what recourse is there, Warner? The question is, you know, so down the road, these process two results in all kinds of diseases. Is there some accountability, some liability?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, I think we're going to get accountability. We're going to get that. We're going to get there. Here is the problem, Paul, that I see. I have no doubt that the moment of truth and the day of accountability will dawn. I have no doubt about it. There is a question as to when. There is a question of how quickly, but I have no doubt about it. It's coming. The problem has been is that this was foisted upon populations so quickly that we really didn't get a chance to think. So we're going to be dealing with the damage from this. We just never had a deliberative process to decide if this is what we wanted to do to ourselves, our families, our cities, and our nations. And yet we got thrust into this. What, 70-some% of Americans have had the shot. Many of those shots are mRNA based and have these problems. So that problem is going to be a very long-term societal problem.
And Warner, maybe you want to talk about the plight of the vaccine injured, just because there are so many of them. and there are not enough lawyers like yourself. So how do these poor people get some kind of justice, and what's going to happen to them?
Well, I have some answers. One of the things that we are doing as quickly as we can is trying to build a group of lawyers, and we're up to about 239, I think was my count today. So we have a group of lawyers. We've got a nonprofit we set up in Ohio called Freedom Council. But we're national. I said Ohio, that's just because I'm here. But we're national. We have attorneys right now in, I think, 36 of the 50 states. So we are helping each other. We're training each other in every element of litigation. And I think for the vaccine injured, I mean, the latest conversation that we've been talking about, which you guys will understand as well, is whether we have access right now, at least for some people, to prove battery. Because informed consent, first of all, you have to have information. And yeah. Nobody knew about the SV40, the open frame, the E. coli, process one, process two. Nobody, the average person doesn't know that. The doctors who gave the shots, the nurses who gave the shots, the pharmacists who gave the shots, they didn't know that. So how can anyone have been given informed consent? If you're not informed, you actually cannot properly consent. And if you have consented and somebody does something to you without being informed and given proper consent, it's called battery. So there is some opening for battery cases, and we're in discussions right now. And those may be able to be brought as what are called mass torts or mass cases. So we're working on that. It's a bit limited. I mean, obviously statutes of limitations have run in a lot of states. They're different state by state. And we need the public's help to extend those statutes of limitations. Just like it was extended for sexual abuse in the church, the Boy Scouts. Let's extend those statutes of limitations so people can get in here and bring their claims. They are just now getting the information they should have had on day one.
That's an important Warner, that you're saying, like, legislators can pass laws to change those statute durations and allow litigation to help these patients and people that were injured. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, we need to realize what our power is. It is tremendous power in Congress and in all our state legislators. And battery is not covered by the PREP Act necessarily, right?
Yep.
So Warner, it's separate. That's an intentional tort.
I have a question for you about these cases of the individual people who've been harmed. And let's just say you win them. You can prove the damage. You can prove that they didn't have adequate consent, the information. And so in cases like these with a big corporation, and certainly with one as rich as pharma, they pay them off. And then you have to sign a document that says they claim no responsibility, and you can't talk about it. And then what happens? I mean, okay, somebody maybe gets to support the medical care that they're going to need for the rest of their life and the devices that they'll have and need in order to breathe or to walk or to think, and their children might get to go to college. But what happens to the rest of the people out there in cases like this? Is that how these are all going to end?
Well, that's a good question. Let me answer it a couple of different ways. First of all, no one is stopping the person from talking about their case once it's filed. So we can all know that it's filed. Those pleadings, those complaints are on the public record. They will describe exactly what happened. And, you know, you'll have discovery, you'll have briefings back and forth. All that will be public. And that's what we do in Freedom Council. We share all of these pleadings with each other so we can see what's working. We've had a couple of battery wins, one in Michigan and one out in Wisconsin.
Warner, let me just stop it. I'm sorry to interrupt. That's what I wanted to ask. Has a battery case been won? Because you just talked about it, but you're just saying that a couple of them have. What were the damages or what were the penalties?
They haven't been won. We're at pleading stages right now. So to dismiss. They move to dismiss because they say, oh, PREP Act applies. Well, we say, no, the hospital protocol or whatever, you know, it doesn't apply here. PrEP Act does not apply here because it's battery. For example, the remdesivir vial in Michigan that had the glass particles in it. The Grace Shara case, who, you know, she could not give consent, and they pushed her family out that had the power to consent to different treatments. So that became a battery. The judge did a great job with that case. So we need to think along these theories. And that's what I'm saying about the vaccine. It's the same way. If you aren't informed, you can't give consent and it becomes a battery. Okay. So I think there's a lot of room for that. And some of those cases are getting worked on right now and will be filed. Freedom Council as a group is filing 2 to 3 cases a week right now around the country. So it's hard for me to even keep up with.
Warner, what about, and I know this isn't the greatest way to compensate or support a vaccine-injured person, but I have one patient who won workman's comp, and she was very happy about that. She said she was the only one so far in Massachusetts, and it was based on what she told me was based on my not only the notes of my consultations, but also she had a very good lawyer, and the state had a really bad lawyer, and the judge ruled in her favor. But is workman's comp another avenue where, because many of my, in my practice, most of my patients can't work. I mean, they're too sick.
I think it's a great avenue, and it holds the employer responsible for doing what they did and mandating it in the employment scenario. Yep. And I mean, think about it. Everybody who's listening, we have never had mandates for adult vaccines, and we've got these employers now imposing this ridiculous mandate. They have no way of knowing whether it's safe, effective. They have no idea, yet they're imposing it because they were bribed essentially or threatened by the federal government. I don't know if you know this, but almost 80% of our workers in this country in one way or another are connected to a federal contract. Every university worker is, for example. You may not think that, but every university almost has some federal contracts. There's a few exceptions that have rejected them. But, you know, so all, you know, we sued Smucker's Corporation. They make jams and jellies. What does Smucker's do? They make 1 million peanut butter and jelly sandwiches a day for military and prisons. Federal contract. It's over $100 million. So, you know, these are the strings that are being pulled, to get these corporations to go along with this program. And, it's illegal for them to do it. Because the PrEP Act itself allows for you to freely decide whether to take a shot or not. And those are being, we'll move on a little bit here, Betsy, to the other issue. These are the employment cases that everyone is running right now. They're hot and heavy right now. There are tens of thousands of employment cases taking place across the United States that are all addressing these points in various different ways. From the right to refuse and not be penalized, to the right to have a religious or medical exemption, there's all kinds of these, and we have many of them. I think we're running about 30 of those cases right now. So one of the biggest ones was for Chris Rake. Chris Rake sued the Regents of the University of California. And we sued that as a class action. It's in Alameda County. It's under the California Constitution. And Chris, even though he's a very religious person, felt that it was his duty as a religious person not to use religion and to just simply refuse. So that is what interested me in the case. He's a fantastic client. There's several others there as well. Some of them, you know, Angela Wilbrick is on that case as well. Mm-hmm. So there's some others. I wish I don't have time to name everybody, but we actually have filed as a class action on behalf of 250,000 University of California employees.
Wow.
And Warner, what about people that lost their employment as a result of refusal?
Well, every last one of them has a case. There is going to be a bit of a problem finding an attorney. That's why Freedom Council exists, is we are, I think, you know, we're filing as many of those and as quickly as we can. Like I said, my little firm on just that issue alone has about 30 of those right now. So
because you would imagine those would be pretty strong cases.
You know, they are. I think they're very strong cases. I think they're very, very good cases. And there was a great Supreme Court ruling called the Groff decision in June of this year. And Groff said that the employer has to show hardship on their side that is substantial hardship if they're not going to accommodate someone for a medical or religious exemption. And I give you an example. We had a deposition of the infectious disease doctor at Children's Hospital here in Akron. And I asked him, I said, okay, what's your hardship there? You're the infectious disease doctor. What's your hardship? Has any patient, any child gotten infected by any of your workers? The answer was no. They had no record of any child getting infected by COVID from one of the workers. And you guys know why. Intuitively, the workers are immune.
Yeah.
They were working in the pandemic for 2 years. They weren't getting sick. They'd had it and gotten past it. And we also looked at their statistics. So we found that, I'll give you just 1 month's statistic. They did have some workers that had COVID. I think it was about 30. Well, about 300 of their patients had COVID. There's no rationale. The patient's coming in with COVID. You're saying, oh, we have to protect the patients. We have to protect the other workers. Well, you can't protect them. You're a hospital. People with COVID are coming in. If a worker gets COVID, they should go home and rest and get better. That's the solution.
You're making too much sense.
This is the infectious disease head for the hospital here.
I like the point that you make, though, and you know, Paul brought it up that, but these loss of livelihood, loss of job cases seem the strongest. And if you see the military, right? Not only did they, I can't remember. You have to tell me. Are they going to pay back pay to all the soldiers that they dismissed? Because now they're recruiting them back. There was an article last week that their recruitment for the military is so bad, they're actually reaching out to former service people to try to bring them back.
Well,
maybe I get that wrong. I don't know.
No, they are. But I think it's very disingenuous what the military is doing. Okay. You know, the soldiers were discharged in a way that they have to clear their names to come back at the status that they were. That process alone, my understanding, can take a couple of years.
Hmm.
So unless they're going to really go in and change military functioning, this thing is foobarred.
Well, what's
what about the pilots?
What about the New York State case where like all the New York City employees?
Yeah.
One judge ruled that they needed to be rehired and be given back pay, but now there's like an appeal or a stay on it or something.
Yeah, that's Sujata Gibson's case. She's done a great job up there, and I think these cases. Don't get me wrong. I think these cases are going to ultimately succeed. This was complete nonsense, and Sujata succeeded. New York has appealed, I believe. The military case, you know, a class action was brought, I believe it was this week, to get the money paid over to the military, because essentially Congress budgeted that money. If they fired, and the military didn't give the money back.
Mm.
The salaries were budgeted and they were paid, and the military has the salaries, this back salary in accounts for the soldiers and sailors and air people, right? They have the money. They're holding it in a bank. They should pay it back. Now, Congress, I think, could easily get involved and just say, hey, pay these people, bring them back. You don't want a requirement. But, you know, here's what they're doing. And you sense this in every institution in the country, but it's very clear in the military. We have purged our institutions, medical, educational, even government, military. We've purged our institutions now to a great extent of some of the most independent, brave thinkers that we've got.
The best people, Warner, the best people.
Now, the reason I'm not saying that overall, because I know some great people remained and they took the shot because they felt they had to for their family or whatever. And I understand that. And I sympathize with that. I certainly understand they were wronged too. Even if they took the shot, they were wronged. Even if they kept their job, they were wronged. And they deserve a recovery too, because it was under lack of informed consent for everybody. So everyone was harmed, whether you took the shot or didn't. But obviously the ones that stood up and had the wherewithal to fight, had the courage to just go at it and could do it, had the support of their families to do it. I mean, those are leaders. And we need those leaders in our institutions, and especially in the military. And one of the things that I've heard about the military, you know, in coming back and going through the process to restore your discharge and correct it, essentially, you've got to come back on bended knee. These aren't people who are going to come back on bended knee. They stood up. So the process has to be dramatically changed to honor the people who stood up and disobeyed or rejected orders that were a violation of international norms and our own constitution. You know, these people stood up against that. And we all know that military people are supposed to stand up when there's a violation of international norms, human rights, and our constitution. And we have to encourage that behavior and make it very clear.
Hey, Betsy, do we have some questions for
Warner? We have a lot of questions. We have a lot of good questions. But one thing, the last program that we had on dealt with the pilots in the military and how many of them, these young people who were in top shape, who took the vaccine because they had to, are now unable to fly. Can there be a class action suit on behalf of them to try to get them, you know, something with the rest of their lives, what they can do?
Well, a class action suit. I'm not sure. I'm not going to have answers for everything, Betsy. I wish I did. Okay. But we have a great group of lawyers that are working very specifically on the military issues. Some of them are ex-JAG officers, and they are working. So we have, you know, in terms of Freedom Council itself as a group, we have kind of specialized groups of lawyers, and the military is a very special institution with very special procedures and requirements, even to get a recovery. And we have a lot of very good ex-military lawyers that are working on those issues right now. And I wish one of them were on here with me right now to talk about what they're doing. But I think they will ultimately, again, this is my answer with everything, again, they're going to get compensation for these people.
This is good to know. Well, here we have a question now from Kirk, who says, what do you say, Warner, about the premise that there is no fraud because this was all planned and protected by legislative and legal statutes passed and incorporated into our laws and statutes and regulations dating back to as far as 1969? This was presented by Sasha Latipova and others.
Well, one of the things that we've already highlighted in our case, and Sasha knows this, is that we've made it very clear that this is a Defense Department project for military readiness, and that it's a military prototype project. So those words to most, the average citizen, I think those are shocking words. Military prototype, DOD, what are you talking about, Warner? That's what I hear. Guess what? The judge wrote it down in his orders. So I don't have to say it. Sasha doesn't have to say it. Go look at what the federal judge found. He found this is a military project. He found that it's a prototype. It's no kind of finished product that we're using. That's a finding. So that's important. And our lawsuit's important at the very least to clarify that. The other thing is, I don't accept that there was no fraud or that we can't get them on the fraud. And I'll tell you why. They had a military contract for, you know, billions of dollars, $100 billion plus. But the contract had a requirement. And that requirement was an emergency use authorization. If they didn't get an emergency use authorization, they didn't deserve a dime. Now, let's go a little deeper for the listener. Pfizer and Moderna did not have to have clinical trials. They could have done away with it. They didn't have to do any clinical trials at all, and I wouldn't probably be sitting here. They could inject dirt into your veins, right? Doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. They could do anything. It's a prototype. You know, like you make a mud car up in Detroit that shows the shape of it. So it doesn't matter. But they chose to have clinical trials. Once you choose to have a clinical trial, then it has to be well-controlled with adequate data. That's how I roll that back. Simple.
All right. Sandra Spears asks, have you connected with Dr. Peter Breggin with his long-term experience fighting Big Pharma and his book, The Global Predators, We Are the Prey?
Well, I've read many of the books that are out there. I'm certainly have read Peter Breggin and have seen, you know, the work that they've done. I think that's an interesting way to put it. I think we're all struggling with what has happened and how to define it. The Breggins have that, you know, that perspective on it, that it's predators and prey. That's not where I go legally. I have to act within the constraints of kind of our legal bounds. And what I would say legally is, and I think there's an argument for this too, and I know Sasha and how she feels, and that this is just a kill box taking people down. And I sympathize with those views. But I think there is an explanation that is different, and we have to be open to all the explanations. And I'm open to all the explanations and all the arguments, and I want to hear them, and I want to try those cases. I want to see the argument, you know, come out. But from a military perspective, they're not really worried about casualties. Remember this. I think the view in the military is, we've got major problems with the ability of individuals now to create viruses in a computer and release them on the world. We have to have a rapid response that's available in a day or two to anything that's created and can run amok in our population. And if it kills a million or so people getting there and figuring this out, well, okay, those are the casualties of this biological warfare that we're experiencing right now. So I'm just positing that as another theory, that there is this idea they need to have this very rapid biological response. Unfortunately, I think that the response itself and the system that has been set up violates all our rights, and that has to be corrected. And I think there's brilliant doctors out there like Paul Merrick and Pierre Corey and others who will help us get through this with repurposed drugs and other things that can work as antivirals. And we cannot have a top-down decision-making, an authoritarian decision that, oh, this is how society is going to run. We may well want it to run that way. We may find out that's all we can do, but not now. And you can't decide from the top. You can't violate all our rights. So that's what we've got to correct.
Here's a good question that gets to that too. Karen Iacovelli says, hi, Warner. And she says,
Hi, Karen.
Has any state AG filed suit against Pfizer and media false advertising using state or federal consumer protection laws?
Well, yes, the Florida effort is definitely that. And that effort is ongoing. I don't know whether Florida has updated you guys on that yet or not, but there is an open grand jury and it's still sitting and they're still taking evidence. And it's a criminal potential charge because of the violations of the consumer protection laws. Other states out there, such as Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, I'm trying to think, those for sure are looking at this as an issue. Attorney generals all over the country ought to be looking at how to apply state law to what they did. And we're here to help. I mean, whatever we can do, we've become sort of, because of some of the cases we've done, we've become a hub of information. And we certainly can put people in touch very quickly at the AG level. If they want to call us, we'll provide everything we have.
We can talk about other avenues of potential help. Here's a question from Jill, who says, you know, we've all been told to work with our local officials to enact change. But when it comes to issues like Exit the Who, can our local reps influence Congress at all? You were in government. You know what the local government was like.
Well, look, the our entire governmental systems have been overrun by the money. So we got to pay attention to it, because money has flowed down to our local school boards, our boards of health, our city councils, and they have strings attached. And they have to do all things practicable. This is the wording in these contracts, all things practicable to follow CDC guidance. So this is the mystery of the CDC. How did the CDC and the FDA get all this control over healthcare and all this stuff? Not by law, because they're just recommendations. You'll hear them say that. They got it by contract. The contracts are what are driving your school board, your local health boards, your cities. So, but by doing all things practicable, my comeback to that is it's not practicable to violate the Constitution and human and civil rights. So just that as a lawyer, that's what I advise. If a board, and some have actually approached me, we advise them it's not practicable to violate the Constitution, so don't do it. Take the money if you think you have to, but don't violate the Constitution. That contract doesn't allow you to violate the Constitution, but that's how they got control of everybody. And that's why local government officials look at you with blank stares when you go down and protest, because they feel like they're hamstrung by the contract they signed, but they're not. There's a way out. And if all of the local officials rejected it, as long as we stand together, we're going to be strong.
All right. Here's a tough one from Florida. Sharon Smith says, my healthy husband was murdered in Florida hospital on August 11th, 2021. Governor DeSantis put a one-year statute on anything COVID, so we're not able to go after the doctors, nurses, and hospital administrators. We don't have any attorneys that will step up and take our cases. Can you give me any help on that?
We talked about that before. Have your state legislature fix that law. Have Governor DeSantis fix that law. They can do it. Fix it. We have to, you know, those of us who have been victimized by this or injured by the shots or remdesivir or hospital protocols, you guys are a powerful force. And I feel like what we're doing and what we'll have is an army of activists very soon. That army of activists needs to come together. Look at what Bree Dressen did with React 19. She's probably got 30,000 stories of vaccine injured there. That's an army. That army can do a lot of good. And we are working on some kind of new ways of litigating that is going to turn that army around. So for example, the VAERS reporting system, all the ones that were injured that were not reported to VAERS, guess what? I can gather you up in a little group and have a lawsuit on that against whoever failed to report, hospital failed to report. The ones that were injured by remdesivir, same thing. We've got people who, there was a contraindication for kidney and liver disease initially. They changed that in June. But gather up a little group of people who are injured by remdesivir at a certain hospital that had the pre-existing kidney and liver disease. As victims, you know what happened to your family member. You know whether they had the contraindication. We can sue the hospital then for fraud. So we can turn this. We can use this army of people injured, damaged, hurt, frustrated, and we can turn this on the institutions and go right at them. Because you have the data that I need, and I'm trying to teach, we're teaching other attorneys. I mean, we could sue all 2,800 hospitals in this country right now, today, but we need to turn it on them. The statute of limitations on that is a lot longer. It's 6 years. The fraud statute of limitations under the False Claims Act is 6 years. So we got some time. We're just getting geared up, folks.
Nice.
You just answered Christine Johnson's question on remdesivir. We have a number of people from Rumble who are watching on Rumble who have asked, is there any legal way to just stop the shots?
Well, I mean, a legal way, yes, there is. We're certainly working on that. I mean, the problem with it is how long it takes. I mean, obviously, Brooke Jackson's case would stop Pfizer. I think a similar case could be brought against Moderna and Novavax and Johnson & Johnson and all the vaccine makers, frankly. And in fact, I mean, I want people to realize this. The entire pharma industry, these clinical trials, it's not just this one. Ventavia does hundreds of clinical trials. That's the company that subcontracted for Pfizer, hundreds of them. They're all bad. Their process is wrong. It's flawed. Not just for Pfizer, for everything. That's why these old drugs are so important. The old repurposed and old effective drugs, pay attention to that. Use safe, effective drugs that have been proven over generations. That's what we need to focus on. You want to get up there and use these new drugs, understand the clinical trials are a mess at every level in this country. Think
turtles
about
all the way down, right?
It's not just vaccines, though. It's every drug. Clinical trials themselves are complete train wreck right now.
And Warner, I mean, one way of thinking about that, right? So you're describing Ventavia, which is a CRO, right? A contract research organization. Right. They conduct these trials. They have every incentive to keep their clients happy.
Of course.
Right? I mean, they're being paid money to do trials, not to show that their favorite drugs don't work or are dangerous. I mean, they have every incentive to do this kind of nonsense.
I'll give you a couple of other quick things. You know, pediatricians are being given money for enrolling children into trials. Adult medicine doctors are being paid money. I think in one case I saw it was $15, $100 a head. If you could get one of your patients to enroll, you got $1,500. Well, some of these doctor's offices have tens of thousands of patients. And they use their patients they mine their patients, and they are paid by pharma to enroll them into clinical trials. This is a dirty, dirty, deadly system that we have set up right now that needs completely overhauled. And we need to have we need to have people in charge of those systems who understand the flaws. Brooke Jackson should be in charge of setting up the clinical trials and what the relationship should be. She saw it up close and personal. So just be aware, everybody. Clinical trials, this whole process is completely corrupt at this point. And it is very, very untrustworthy. And the FDA, of course, is funded by pharma as well, the CDC. I mean, we see pharma dollars everywhere. We have to eliminate that. We have to take all conflicts of interest out of this and get back to science. This is not science. This is, I don't know what to call this, actually.
But Warner, your point, every point you made, the shocking thing to me was not only discovering all of this corruption and fraud, but it's also the duration of time in which it has been occurring. This is not a new phenomenon. It's just the scope and the scale was overwhelming. But geez, you know, this stuff has been going on for decades.
Yeah, it has gotten worse. I mean, I can tell you that it has gotten worse. You had, you know, there's a law we use in the, there's something we use in the law called Gresham's Law. Do you know what that is?
No.
It's very simple. If bad can get away with what it's doing, it will drive out good. And right now, that's what I meant when I said fraud is the business model. The bad is driving out the good. So the good actors they're trying. I know many, many good companies and good actors, but they are up against it because the bad is driving them out. The bad is bribing, say, the nursing home to get the medical contracts or bribing the doctors to get the clinical trial stuff going. So the bad is driving out the good in our society. And it's doing it through all these conflicts of interest. So once we recognize that, we've got to diagnose the problem, which we're in the midst of doing as a society. I truly believe you guys, by the way, are part of the antibodies. that are fighting this disease that we're diagnosing. But we will fight it and we will fix it. And we really are acting as antibodies to the civic body that we have to deal with, the political, civic being that we're dealing with. So I have no doubt about it.
We have probably one last question here that kind of covers the whole thing. Michelle Rabin says, why is the government allowing Pfizer to continue to do business? Why is fraud now an acceptable business practice? Is it all this?
It's all money. Oh, yeah, definitely. It's the money that's flowing to the politicians and the media power of these pharmaceutical companies. You know, we started there in this conversation. We haven't covered half of what I think we've had on our list to cover, but you know, they control the media, they control the narrative. You're not getting information through the mainstream sources.
Can I give an anecdote there? I've been telling it to colleagues and my network. I don't think I've told you this, Warner, but over Thanksgiving, I was at a dinner. A lot of family and friends were there. And there was a pathologist there, and he and I were chatting, talking a little bit of shop, system pathologist, private practice. And I just came right out and I said to this person, I said, are you guys staining for spike protein? And you know what the answer was? Because your opening video to this webinar, you talked about the spike protein very accurately, very specifically. You understand that it's a pathogen, it's causing problems. So this is a pathologist. And his answer was, what is that?
Oh.
And then let me just continue with the next few statements. So he first says, what is that? Is that something to do with vaccination? And I was silent. I didn't even know what to say in response to that. And then he says, I don't understand all this vaccination, all this controversy around the vaccines. All I know is that the vaccinated are sick for 2 days and the unvaccinated are sick for 2 weeks. And so after hearing this, I actually turned away. I had to go back to planet Earth. But, you know, it is a really shocking example when you talk, because you just talked about the propaganda, the narrative, not only in the media, but really in the medical journals, the censorship of true objective data showing the harms of these vaccines. You can't get that stuff published. And when you do get it published, it gets retracted. And so the doctors are living on a diet of really curated and really fraudulent information. So I have to hear this from a guy that I respect. I really like. He's a good guy, a very responsible doctor committed to his field. And his answer is, what is that? He doesn't know what the spike protein is. And he doesn't know that you should stain for it because it's a pathogen. And so we got a lot of work to do, Warner.
I got to throw another one in here. This is Marjorie McLean. Are there any suits for unauthorized practice of medicine or corporate practice of medicine? My relative was harmed at an Arizona hospital and the doctor wanted to try some options, but he said for COVID, the hospital policy only allowed for the federal protocol to be followed. The doctor was only there to write prescriptions and was not allowed to practice. The decisions were made by corporate policy.
That is a fantastic point. I will tell you, we are spending a lot of time parsing through how we go at that problem. So there are probably some lawsuits filed that I may not know about on corporate practice of medicine, but I can tell you that I am personally very interested in that issue. And I have a big stack of papers back here on corporate practice of medicine, because that's just not how it's supposed to go. And in fact, when Medicare was founded, I always go back to foundational documents. If you go back to Medicare in the 60s, one of the big things the American Medical Association was concerned about was the interference with the doctor-patient relationship. So the original founding statute, it protects the doctor's decision-making. We've forgotten this, but it's in there. And we need to make sure that that's revived and the corporate practice of medicine is destroyed.
And more, that issue you just brought up, because I know Stephen Warshawski is part of the Freedom Council, right? With you, you work closely. I'm one of his expert witnesses on the Bucco case. Betsy was on the ground, on the fly, in real time, supporting Scott and Deborah Bucco. That is a really shocking and very brazen case of the corporate practice of medicine. I hope that case will be a bellwether and maybe a landmark decision. And
Stephen's on our board, by the way. He's a great attorney. He's been so helpful. You know, we have so many attorneys. He's one of the ones who I, you know, always get a good argument out of him. For or against what your position is. It's fantastic. I mean, that's what we do as lawyers. So I appreciate someone who can argue with me and bring up points that I'm not paying attention to necessarily. So Stephen is fantastic at that. He's helping to train a lot of lawyers on a lot of law. So he's just been wonderful. He's wonderful to have on the board. He's wonderful to argue with. You know, that's so thank you for bringing him up, and he's leading that fight. So
I'm
thank you for being here and for what you're doing, and Paul and Pierre for, you know, being the brains to be able to argue this stuff and having the heart and the guts and the smarts. I mean, honestly, you guys are doing critical work, critical humanitarian work, and thank God for you. That's all I can say.
Well, it is not us. I mean, Catherine Hewig's our executive director. She's done a fantastic job. She pushes me every day to do more, you know, and, you know, all the people who are out there who are working together and training each other, like you guys are training each other as doctors. We're training each other as lawyers. I mean, it takes this massive effort. I mean, I happen to be talking to you now, but I mean, there's so many other people in Freedom Council who could do this job equally well. And you know, we'll, you know, Pierre, you and I are going to age out of this before it's over, I'm sure.
You.
But I mean, we just have such, you know, we have this commitment. You know, the folks who took the spiritual leap of faith to fight, whatever your beliefs may be, you know, but whatever, all the ones that took that leap of faith, we are a core of, we are foundation stones for reviving the democracy and reviving the Constitution. And they are, and these people, I was worried. I went to a meeting the other day of the Children's Hospital. Several hundred people were fired, and we're years in the litigation now, years. And they called a meeting, a dinner meeting. And I went out there, and I was going out there. I hadn't seen anybody for months and months. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, who's going to show up? This battle's been going on for so long. Everybody's lost their jobs or had to move on. Who's going to show up? I showed up. I was really amazed at how many people came.
Yes.
And how enthusiastic they were. And I can tell you, they're rock solid. And their understanding is so much more than it was then. They have learned. So I know there's rock solid Americans out there. We're going to get this job done. We're not going to let our country fail. It's just not.
We're going to get it back, Warner. You gave me a lot of hope tonight. I know you're fighting. We're doing what we can, but we got to get back our country and our freedoms and carry on in
a more. You said it. I'll drop one of the words that you said, but you know, everybody knows now you cannot comply.
Yes.
You cannot comply. The next thing that comes down the pike, you know, whether it's digital currency or whatever, anything that's gaining control and is unconstitutional, do not comply. Don't wear masks. Don't take these crazy shots or whatever the next shot or medicine they want to foist upon us. Be very discerning and be very skeptical, and do not comply until you're convinced that you're doing the right thing for yourself and your family. That is the core issue. And you cannot comply without informed consent.
Informed consent.
Thank you, Warner. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks. Absolutely.
You're going to have to come back.
Thank you, Warner.
You're going to have to come back. We have to do this again. You're going to have updates. No question about that.
Do not comply, Warner.
And Warner, let me know if you get 500 cases in the next few days.
I don't know. Well, I just thank everybody who's listening. If they want to get a hold of us at this point, right before we came on, ironically, our website went down. I haven't had a chance to even look at why. It does make you wonder sometimes. But if you want to get hold of us for now, just send an email at info@freedomcouncil.org. Council is S-E-L, Council, info@freedomcouncil.org. And I did you put some other links up there, I guess, Betsy? But, you know, we are really
Team behind the scenes did it, I'm sure. It's on chat.
If you know a lawyer, that if you guys out there who are listening know a lawyer or a doctor, we need them. We need those lawyers to contact us. And we've got 239 as of today. Liberty Council, which is another great group out there fighting. They've got several hundred. Children's Health Defense got several hundred. So there's some crossover in there, but we need to build an army of lawyers as well. We have an army of the injured, and we need an army of lawyers as well to assist them in bringing their fight to the courts.
And a lot more doctors.
Send your lawyers our way. Send your doctors our way. And remember, we've got to fight for legislative solutions. Elections are coming up. Let's make it front and center.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. I've got a lot of announcements to make here. We'll see you. We'll see you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Warner. Thanks.
Such a pleasure. Such an honor, everybody. Thanks.
All right, folks. We have a lot to tell you about because we've got some good upcoming webinars. Thank you, of course, for being with us for tonight's discussion. But we have two upcoming webinars that you want to know about, as they will be covering very important topics. Next week, we will zero in what's going on with the WHO. The World Health Organization. And boy, is that an interesting and scary topic. Dr. Marek and Dr. Corey will be joined by special guests, Dr. Merrill Nass and Dr. Kat Lindley, incredible physicians and warriors of truth. The following week, December 13th, our Dr. Christina Carmen will join Dr. Marek to discuss how we all can have healthy holidays in body and mind. They will focus on things we all can do to keep ourselves healthy, properly nourished, and, well, sane over the upcoming holiday period. While we're discussing upcoming events, we cannot forget to mention that the clock is ticking on early bird pricing for our third FLCCC educational conference. It's taking place February 2nd to 4th, 2024, almost here, in Phoenix, Arizona. The lineup of speakers is phenomenal. Plus, it will be a weekend of connecting and sharing and learning with the biggest giving season upon us. You can think of this as the biggest gift to yourself, you know, a gift of health and knowledge. So have a look at the speakers, learn more, then save your seat today at flccc.net/conference. Okay, we have a new guide for you. We always talking about learning. That's what we do. This one just out is the one on understanding remdesivir. This drug has been given in hospitals to patients with COVID and tragically has earned the nickname Run Death is Near. In this guide, you will find information about the drug and its history, research studies, and who supports it, the use of it, and much, much, much more. You can read and download this guide at the link on the screen or find it on our website under the Tools and Guides tab. All right, our own Dr. Bean has been busy as ever. You know, he has a new episode of Long Story Short out. In it, he shares a study from Israel demonstrating that men's sperm concentration temporarily reduces after the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Remember that a couple of years ago when this would have been, it would have sounded like a crazy conspiracy theory. And now we have real and disturbing data. You can watch it on our FLCCC Alliance Rumble and Odyssey channels or on our website at flccc.net/Dr. Bean. Let's go to something a little bit more fun. Our online store is full of new cozy winter wears and holiday must-haves, from leather bomber jackets to, wait for it, FLCCC wrapping paper. I understand the designs are by Dr. Bean, who is a fun personality, even though he does serious scientific investigations, but he's a fun cartoonist. Anyway, you can find the perfect gift for the awakened friends and family members in your life. And with that, let's bring up the woman behind these creative designs, Christina Maros, who is a wonderful nurse, and the other nurses who've been answering your questions behind the scenes. Christina, Sam, Emily, thank you for being here. Welcome to all that you've been doing. Tell us about these incredible items.
Well, you know, it's winter time, Betsy, so we needed jackets and we needed winter gear. So we have these lovely bomber jackets. We have Columbia fleece jackets and some other things and wrapping paper so you can wrap up your jackets and give them to your friends. And we also have lovely hats and athletic gear you can buy all for all of your family members. And look, oh, Samantha has the same hat on. We're like twinsies.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Winter. And also, Betsy, you gotta get a hat.
Yes, you have to get a hat. And we were talking about the military tonight, Betsy. I wanted to bring attention to our military Twitter space we had yesterday. Ooh. All the people interested in that topic, they can listen to it on, if they go to our Twitter account, they can listen to the recording now from yesterday.
Super. Thank you for bringing that up. Well, and, you know, let's hope everybody, I think this is just so cool. I love the slide and I know there are a lot more things there even so. And thank you. How were the questions tonight? Did you get a lot? Were you able to, I mean, of course, a lot of them were on the law. So I guess that was a little out of your territory.
We had a lot of questions. Sam, what do you think?
I feel like everybody got all ready with their questions over last week's break. We had so many, but Warner did a great job. He answered so many. Yeah,
he sure did. We'll have to have him back. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much. And we will see you next week. Now, I just want to thank the folks. Last but not least, we want to, you know, announce the launch, folks, of our end of year campaign, our 2023 campaign, Share the Light. Thanks to you, our supporters, we have reached and saved millions of lives, but we're not done yet. No way. As you can tell, there's a lot more to do. It's time to move past the sick model of medical care and to create a new health paradigm, one that puts patients, people, imagine that first, not profits of anything, one that focuses on prevention and true wellness. Please help us do more work, reach more people, save more lives. Help us share the light. You'll see a nice video in a minute that shows more about this. And you can learn more about the campaign or make a gift today at flccc.net/donate. We thank you, thank you, thank you for all that you have done, all that you continue to do. And we'll see you next week. Bye.
In a world of uncertainty, the FLCCC has arisen as a beacon of truth. The last few years have been filled with confusion, misinformation, and outright lies. All around us, people are injured and suffering as a result. Our healthcare system is irretrievably broken. Now more than ever, we need to stand in the gap for ourselves, our children, and generations to come. The FLCCC offers hope, cutting through the noise and propaganda with well-researched, science-based information. Our mission? To save lives and restore the sacred doctor-patient relationship. Our founders have dedicated themselves to treating patients with innovative therapies, developing treatment guidelines, and educating healthcare professionals and consumers around the world. That's why people trust us. We have a moral imperative to keep pursuing this critical work. With your support, the FLCCC has reached millions of people, hosted informative webinars and conferences, published crucial research, advocated for doctors and patients, and most importantly, saved lives. People everywhere are searching for solutions And with your help, we can continue to light the way for truth and health. Please share the light with us. Make a gift today and be a torchbearer in our movement for change. Each and every dollar counts. Your support allows the FLCCC to continue its mission and ignite a much-needed healthcare revolution. Together, we can make a difference. Together, we can share the light. Thank you for partnering with us in this critical mission.